And welcome to the program. I'm your host, George Rideout, and always working the soundboard is Lynn. And today is part two of our talk and sharing with Michael Tazarian, who's an expert on the occult histories of Ireland and America. He is the author of the acclaimed book Atlantis, Alien Visitation and Genetic Manipulation, and is the producer and presenter of the Origins and Oracle series, which explores ancient mysteries and forbidden knowledge. His many appearances on metaphysical radio and TV programs, along with his lectures and workshops, have given rise to the name Teacher's Teacher. If you want, definitely check out Michael's website. It is one of the most amazing websites I've come across. It's www.michaeltazarian.com. He is metaphysician extraordinaire. He is Michael Tazarian, and we are pleased to have him here with us again this morning. Are you there, Michael?
Hello, George. Nice to be back.
Great to have you back. We got into a great beginning last week with psychic vampirism, and it's a great opener to what we'll be talking about today. And I thought we'd start off with the origins of evil. Explain, what is a conspiracy theory?
Well, there is really no such thing as a conspiracy theory. That's mostly a derogatory term that's been used to basically marginalize and, I believe, ridicule people with an open mind, and society has many ways of sort of ridiculing people who are free thinkers and people who are able to connect a seemingly, disparate realities or disparate things, and yet it's incredible, isn't it, that the human brain, they say that the heaviest human brains are those who have most synapses. For instance, women's brains are heavier than men's because they have more synapses, and synapses get created when exactly that happens, when your biology, when your thinking patterns are able to connect unlikely things in a non-linear way. It turns out that your brain is actually heavier, meaning you're smarter, but should you actually act upon that or speak, openly about connecting disparate things, then you're called a conspiracy nut. It basically is for people who read behind the lines, who see the interlocking, interconnecting, people who have developed what's called pattern recognition. Now, you see, we're very hypocritical because in society we will promote and honor people who can do that when there's a material sort of component. Say that you're an art critic or a movie critic or even a really, really good editor. These are people who do exactly that. They're able to read behind the lines of what a movie maker is saying. A great literature critic can tell you all sorts of things about the life of a famous author, like Thomas Hardy or Jane Austen, by reading between the lines and bringing out all of this color and tone. And people are just aghast when these people talk, They're like considered, the great intellects of our time, the people who can do this. But the moment that you do exactly the same thing in a social sphere or in a political sphere, you're a conspiracy nut. So it's a complete hypocrisy because there's nothing that a good conspiracy author does that is not already being done by any other kind of critic in any other field. It's just that for some reason, probably because of the implications, a person who makes these connections, it's very threatening to the ordinary person. And, of course, conspiracy, people don't run around, seeking money and seeking fame and things like that. So, they're pretty much a threat.
Being an objective observer, really.
Isn't it? And, I always do say, I can understand one reason why people who are in alternative history or alternative, the research community get a little bit, lambasted, is because, unfortunately, unlike a lot of critics and unlike a lot of, skilled speculators, in the conspiracy movement, you get too many people who really don't know what they're doing. The UFO movement is full of people like that, and the New Age movement is full of like that. And these are people who do too much label reading. Mm-hmm. And they don't really pursue in an erudite or, efficient way this kind of subject. So, in fact, they do injustice to the subject. And I've been saying this for a long, long time, that if you're going to work to expose government corruption, or you're going to maybe be looking into, something like the 9/11 mystery or, any other area that is really alternative and that already is very taboo, then the worst thing that you can do is do a bad job of it and then come on the media.
Yeah.
So that the first moment you open your mouth, somebody like Bill O'Reilly or anybody of that background can completely destroy you.
Yeah.
You're not only going to look bad yourself. What's going to happen to you is that you're also going to bring bad reputation to the sacred knowledge. And this is what has been going on for, you know, too long, that people who are either, you know, they're not able to carry, see, it's not just the knowledge, you have to be able to carry it. You have to be able to deliver it in an erudite way. You have to present yourself correctly. You have to know your facts, and you have to know your enemy.
Yeah, that's for sure.
And unfortunately, this is not the case, which is why so many times when somebody comes on radio or goes on the public sphere or tries to come before the media, they're immediately shot down by these hosts, even on PBS, but certainly on the mainstream, because they have not done their homework to already prepare to know the mindset of these people, so to be able to come back at them very, very hard, and therefore do justice to these radical subjects.
So are the people that you see on TV, are they the architects of the whole game that's being played?
No, very, very rarely. In fact, these are the people at the you know, that you actually see in the public eye have themselves only a very faint understanding. They might be called, you know, what you would call on probation. These are people who may later on get rank, you know, but it'll take them 30 years, and they really have to prove it. You know, for somebody to get a knighthood, for somebody to be, you know, brought up the ladder, they've got to really prove that they serve the system, that they bought into the ideology. But even the people, you know, from it depends what perspective you're on. If you're on the bottom tier of the pyramid, the power pyramid, then yeah, that, you know, the Luce, Henry Luce, you know, and whoever, you know, Catherine Graham and you know, Dan Rather and people of that ilk, the people that you see in the media, they may look mighty high to you because, you know, we're down here on the bottom of the pyramid. So they seem to have a station a little bit above us. You know, these television pundits, certain, you know, people like John Cameron, you know, the makers of films and so on. Yeah, they could look pretty illustrious, you know, the Spielbergs and everything. But, you know, if you're further up the pyramid, you know, they're nothing.
Yeah.
They're nothing. It's a matter of perspective. Of course, everybody like that, usually these massively egotistical people, they're always legends in their own mind.
Yeah, exactly.
So the moment that they get a little bit of actual, you know, kudos, or the moment that they're actually initiated into a certain kind of mystery, or that they're instructed, you know, or given more budget or whatever, then, of course, their ego goes out the window, you know.
So who is at the top of the pyramid?
Well, the top of the pyramid, you know, a pyramid does have a top. And a pyramid also has four sides. And therefore, there are the individuals at the top. If you look at the symbols that they use themselves, the Masonic symbols, you will see that the pyramidon at the top is actually removed from the main pyramid. And this is their own symbolism.
Kind of like
it's
on
not
the
just
dollar.
A continuous pyramid. They talk about the missing capstone. They talk about, you know, and if you look on the dollar bill to get an image of what they're showing you themselves, you'll also notice that the top 14th layer is two-dimensional, whereas the pyramid, of course, is three-dimensional.
Mm.
So they're almost even saying that the people at the top are not even on the same dimension as, you know, the people that they control below.
That's
or the system that they control below.
That's a really interesting point.
It is. It's really remarkable. But more important than that is if people have really done their homework, they will be able to see at a glance that the symbolism is Egyptian. So we're already being told something here in the symbolism to look to Egypt. And when we look to Egypt, if people have followed my work specifically, they will know that the eye at the top of the pyramid is not just the eye of Horus or the eye of Ra, like so many people who haven't done their homework are throwing around that information, because the light, the beams of light that are coming out of the eye, and the Egyptian name for the word eye, and also the Hindu word for the word eye, is Akka. A, the letter A in Egyptian, had the symbol of an eagle, right? So if you wrote the letter A, of course we know that the Egyptians never used, writing, but normally we are familiar with Egyptian hieroglyphics,
right?
So they used the hierogram. The hieroglyphic for the letter A, our letter A, was an eagle. Well, you see an eagle on the other side of the pyramid. In fact, an eagle is looking at the pyramid. Then the pyramid itself is Egyptian. And the capstone looks like a letter A. So the letter A and the eagle are connected. They're exactly the same symbol. They mean the same thing, Akka. But the eagle was the symbol of Aton or Akhenaton. This is the symbol of the pharaohs, you see, and the royal dynasties. That's why the Romans used the standard of the eagle. The Greeks have used it. The Nazis have used it. And now the American government are using it. And the American government are known to use Egyptian symbolism left, right, and center. That eagle on the dollar bill is not a Judaic eagle, but an Egyptian eagle coming from the time of the cult of Aton. And the cult of Aton is what people need to really study, especially in an American context, George, because we have now, since the time of G. Edward Griffin and Eustace Mullins, started to get a handle on the fact that there are secret societies operating in the world. You know, you can say that in England, in the early part of the 19th century, you know, books have been written on this. But if you're just dealing with an American context, then it is extremely modern. It's an extremely modern phenomena for the American people and American authors and American investigative journalists to start working on the theme of secret societies operating. You know, a couple of people, you know, like Louis McFadden and Charles Lindbergh Sr., that's Charles Lindbergh's father, you know, and Francis Coughlin, and one or two others had mentioned it sort of in passing. But books, when it started to be written about in literature, is a very, very recent phenomenon. It dates basically to Eustace Mullins and G. Edward Griffin and people like that. So what I'm trying to say is that because it's new, there's also a lot of pitfalls in that. Because it's new, people are still in the sort of research, you know, the early stages of the research. And therefore, people are pointing here, they're pointing there for the origins. You know, so your question of coming straight to the point is almost a historical thing, you know. It's not something that is an old case in America to ask who is it that is at the top of the pyramid. It's one of the most important questions we begin asking because the answers are still really not known yet. People go so far as being able to point, oh, the Jesuits, oh, wait, no, it's the Masons, oh, wait, it's these guys called the Knights Templar, you know, and et cetera, et cetera. Or, you know, it might be the church or whatever. And, you know, that's great, but you see, a person can get caught into those whirlpools and remain there forever.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's
You know, they got to look at the symbolism and they got to trace it back and find out that this thing goes way back. It's much older than America. It's much older than Europe. It goes right back into the old Druidic symbols of Ireland, for instance, and it goes back into the old Egyptian cults of the sun. And you, believe it or not, even though, you know, 4,000 years have gone by, that's not a lot of time in history.
Yeah, that's true.
There are still dynastic families ruling today, ruling from Europe. They own America through the Hudson Bay Company and the Victoria, Virginia Company, and the Russell Trust, the people in America know better as the Skull and Bone Society and these other organizations. These organizations are funded and controlled by people who are in direct bloodline descendancy from Rome, from the dynasties of Rome, Babylon, and Egypt. They are the ones who are at the top of the pyramid. And they themselves have bloodline that goes even further back to Atlantis.
Do they have any alliances to the Freemasons, or...
No, the Freemasons are part of this infrastructure. They're like a steering committee. They operate, you know, at the behest. They serve two main functions. One is that the Freemason enclaves are these cults. They do provide a very, very good working cover for those who are trying to influence society. That's one of the first things they do. And on the other side, they're a great archivist of ancient knowledge so that it doesn't get lost. Because what we have to understand is that when we hear about book burnings and libraries, the great libraries of the world, you know, being burned and pillaged and sacked, and when we hear about whole cities being sacked of their knowledge and of their treasures, you know, we have this opinion that all those treasures and books are just lost. What we don't realize is that none of that stuff is lost. You read about it in history that, you know, the monasteries got burned down or a great library burned down. What you don't hear about is that, yeah, it got burned down after the knowledge was taken out. So when you're hearing about the rape of the Druids, you know, and the fall of the great Phoenician empires, and, you know, all of this stuff, you've got to realize that that knowledge is sequestered. It's taken. Not only the physical knowledge in the form of books and scrolls and texts, but also the intellectual knowledge has been preserved in the Masonic groups, which is one of the reasons why it's intriguing to study Masonry and even become a Mason. I don't recommend that, but that's one of the reasons why people do that, is because they get a feeling for a history,
yeah.
And they're into being like antiquarians, and
yeah,
they understand the great mystery traditions that would have been lost forever, just in the same way as that during the Dark Ages, the great knowledge of Greece and Rome, the philosophy of Greece was lost, but the Arabs preserved it. This is well known, so that after the Dark Ages, when the great universities were opened in Europe, they were Arab universities, they were Muslim, and through those universities, primarily in Spain, but in other places in the world, the great philosophies of Plato, you see, and Democritus, and Aristotle, you see, and the Neoplatonic scholars was brought back into the West by the Arabs. Well, it's a sort of a same parallel that the knowledge that has been kept from ordinary human beings, and this is one of the reasons why I'm anti-Masonic and anti, you know, these kind of organizations, because even though I recognize that they have been archivists and that they preserve great knowledge in a very pristine way, they've also made sure that the rest of the human race does not get privy to that.
Or else give out lots of disinformation.
Yes, they also are breeders of disinformation.
Yeah.
But you see, there, first of all, there's not just one thing as one Masonic lodge. There's many different kinds of masonry in the world. There, a lot of them can be, appear to be at loggerheads with each other. And masonry serves many different functions. You see, it's a hydra. It's a many-hydra. It's a many-headed thing. It's not just one simple, you know, structure. Because, of course, if they did that, then it would have been exposed years ago. So they keep many different kinds of grades. They keep many different kinds of personality out there. So that it becomes very slippery, and it's hard to grasp. There's some Christian masonry groups, you see. There's Islamic ones. There's ones that allow females to be joining. There's ones that, you know, deal in occultism. There's others that are more charitable. So, you know, when somebody's going, the Masons, other people can come along and go, oh, well, what are you talking about? You know, you can't be serious. These Masonic orders don't have any, you know, negative agenda, because look at all the good that they do over here, or, you know, they've been active in politics over there, or they're great charitable people over here, you know, and, oh, look, they were, if we didn't have them, you know, then we couldn't have had a French underground, for instance, that fought the Nazis, you see. So there's all sorts of slants, which is, again, why people have to do their homework and really be specific about who and what, you know, they're accusing.
When we hear about the Fabian Way, who were the Fabians?
Well, basically the Fabians are socialists. Remember, I think we were talking before about what happens when human beings, when these individuals combine occultism and politics together, then you have a lethal cocktail. Well, the Fabians on paper are merely socialistic people, left-wing, very much like your Democratic Party in America, only very wealthy ones, which is sort of a contradiction in terms. How can you be, you know, Democratic and yet multimillionaires? Well, this is how it works in the socialist movement. And these are people who are definitely Freemasonic-backed. They're either members of the Freemasons themselves, or they're organizations who are started by Freemasons, or that they are very closely aligned with Freemasons. But on paper, the Fabians are a left-wing organization that started in Oxford University by a man called Sidney Webb. But the Webbs were not just political people, and neither were many of the other Fabians that they hung around with. These were people who were very much involved in theosophy, anthroposophy, and in Freemasonry and in Eastern mysticism. So they had an occult aspect as well. And their gurus were people like Alice Bailey and Annie Besant, who took over, you know, the Theosophical Society after Madame Blavatsky died. And Madame Blavatsky is often erroneously, you know, blamed for the changes within the Theosophical Society. It was complete nonsense, because she had already died. And when she was alive, you know, she was constantly warning people about mixing politics and occultism together. Now, the Fabian Society, from an American context, it's very, very important for people to realize that, because the Council on Foreign Relations, you see, and the Trilateral Commission, a lot of these organizations were funded and created by British Fabians. And one of the most important British Fabians was, of course, Cecil Rhodes of the Rhodes Roundtable, Rhodes Scholarship. And it's these individuals who then came over with their henchmen. They attracted and initiated many so-called American men and formed these organizations that basically control the American government now. So what had happened was, I think that they realized at some point, either they didn't want to, or either because they tried it and failed, they knew that they could never take America by force of arms. Remember the old War of Independence?
Yep.
Well, the War of Independence was also very much an occult war. It wasn't something that most people realized. First of all, it was not won. Americans didn't win it. You know, there's an old statement that Americans are famous for losing the wars they win. And it's a very brilliant statement, that, because, in fact, the American didn't win. But for some reason, it was discovered that the British, if they moved in an oligarchical way, like opening their banks and having a king, all that stuff they tried in the beginning where, you know, just it would be like England, that they'd be a royal family and all of these things, that wasn't going to work, because you had far too many rebellious, disgruntled people here, and that just wouldn't have worked economically. So it was decided that the war had to come in through the back door. That if you war with these people openly, it's just not going to work. But that doesn't mean that the British system, which has colonies throughout the entire world, right, which has subjugated India, which has subjugated Africa, which subjugated China in the 1890s, is just going to go, okay, well, we'll just forget about America then. This uncharted place, you know, full of ore, and full of forests and full of fishery, you know, you think they're just going to say no way to that and leave because, you know, they, I mean, Canada is, you know, just as big as America.
Yeah.
You think they're going to say no to all of this? You know, the Queen of England still owns all of Canada to this day. There's barely a patch in Canada she doesn't own. So they already own Canada. They basically, you know, through their colleagues at the Vatican, they own South America. So they're not going to let America go, but they realize that if they do it in an open way, it could happen that they might be completely overthrown because America, you know, is already calling on the Tsar of Russia and many other, you know, places that are hostile to this system, the British system. And it could happen that the Americans, if pushed too far, that they do amass an army and they do, in fact, have, you know, they do get allies from Russia and from other places, you know, there could be trouble. There could be a vast world war, and that might cost the British too much. So it was at that time, after the War of Independence, that they decided to move in with the Fabian organization. And the Fabian motto is the War of Attrition. Very, very slow, gradual progress or move towards the same goal. War is what, you know, in a couple of years, you want to attain your goal. But there's also a lot of loss that comes with that. There's also a lot of logistics is required there. And it also brings you a really bad name as well. So, there's also a possibility that you might lose. So all in all, it was decided to work on the American front in a little bit different way. And that is what has happened. And it's taken about 180 years or 200 years for that war of attrition to progress. And certainly by the time of Roosevelt, it is very much heated up because Roosevelt was a major Fabian, so was Truman, and so was Woodrow Wilson, you see. So they start getting their own men in a much more public and open way. So before Roosevelt, it would have been more concealed that the Fabians were operating in society, and many, many American scholars would not have known about it. But certainly by the time of Roosevelt, he did so many bizarre things that were very communistic, very socialistic, like his New Deal. His New Deal was meaningless. All the stuff that you needed to, you know, work to heal the Depression. Well, wait a minute. The Depression was artificially created in the first place. There's nothing to heal. The thing was the New Deal, you know, was brought in over a operation. The same government who bring in the New Deal to save the workers and feed Americans had already impoverished them beforehand. The same group. You see, this is the whole what you call the dialectic at work. You see, it became a little bit obvious then what was going on because the New Deal is patently a communistic manifesto type of creation. Very anti-American, in fact. And this then started to alert scholars and thinkers. And then from that moment on, people started to really realize, wait a minute here, we got something going on. If people had their eyes open before that Roosevelt era, they would have noticed that something was already going wrong in America by the opening of what's called the Federal Reserve, which is the first, you know, private bank of America.
Right, right. Well, image is everything, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. We're going to take our first break, and when we come back, I want to ask you who started the Illuminati.
Okay.
Here is Peter Gabriel in Games Without Frontiers. Enjoy.